This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we run through a number of updates.
We celebrate Lynn Stewart's 74th birthday and ask you to fight for her compassionate release. We remember the 46th anniversary of Che Guevara's murder, and we bring you some statistics about the incredible economic dislocation and poverty in this country. And we'll talk about Obama's abductions, kidnappings, and killings in the northern coast and Horn of Africa.
We'll also speak with Phyllis Bennis of the Center for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
Phyllis will remind us of the incredible killings and murders that are still going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, of the new claimed initiatives in Iran, of what's going on in Syria, and what's happening with the, quote, peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm sure as our listeners know, Lynn Stewart remains imprisoned and has been denied compassionate release so far, despite her illness. There's some updates on her situation, and I'd like Michael Smith to give us a sense of what's going on now with Lynn, Michael.
Well, I'd be happy to, Michael, but also I want to ask our listeners to grab a pen or pencil because I'm going to give you three phone numbers. Lynn, last week, was 74 years old. She wrote a high-spirited letter, which is typical of her personality, about how she's going to get out of there, and next birthday she's not going to be there. Well, she doesn't have many more birthdays ahead of her, and she knows that. She's got metastasized stage 4 breast cancer. And under the law, they should have let her out. The doctor at the prison says she can go. It's being stopped by the director at the Federal Bureau of Prisons, a man named Samuels. So if you got a pencil, I'm going to give you this guy's phone number. There were rallies in various places around the country, including here in New York City last week on Lynn's birthday. The big birthday present people said we're going to give Lynn is to make these calls. So Director Samuels, Federal Bureau of Prisons, he's at 202-307-3250. Repeat, 307-3250. Going up the ladder, Attorney General Eric Holder, he's at 202-353-1555. That's 202-353-1555. And his boss is President Obama, 202-456-1111. That's 456-1111.
Michael, for people who don't catch those numbers on this broadcast, is there a website they can go to look at these?
LynnStewart.org, or you can go to lawanddisorder.org, and we have it posted. So please, give Lynn a birthday present. Help us get her out of there. They gave her a life sentence for essentially issuing a press release. They disbarred her. She's 74 years old. She's not well, and we want her home. She can come back to New York where she gets some good medical attention for a change, and with your help, we can do that.
Today we're recording this show on Wednesday, October 9th, and it's a significant day for Michael and I, but particularly for the world and for its revolutionary leaders, or one of its revolutionary leaders. And Michael and I authored a book about this person. Michael, who are we talking about?
Well, Che Guevara, October 9th, 1967, exactly 46 years ago, exactly not only to the day, Michael, but to the hour. when the Bolivian army sergeant, at the request of the CIA, shot Che. It was exactly at this time, on October 9th of 1967. The book we wrote is, of course, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. Michael had the presence of mind to do a Freedom of Information Act request many years ago. He got a couple of boxes full of documents, and then 6 years ago, he got a couple of more boxes full of documents. We read them. There's a lot of information now that didn't exist 46 years ago that we now have, and we were able to demonstrate in our book, Who Killed Che, that the plausible deniability story that the president and the CIA put out about how, oh, it was the Bolivians, we had nothing to do with it, is total BS. We've got the documents to prove it. Ricardo Alarcón, the former president of the Cuban National Assembly, wrote the introduction to the book, and it's still available, OR Books, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And you'll see how the United States assassinated Che as part really of its half-century-long program to reverse or contain revolutions around the world, particularly the Cuban Revolution.
And so today we remember the murder of revolutionary Che Guevara.
Michael, you've got two children that have recently graduated from college. I have one. It's not looking up for young people these days, not at all. And we've got some statistics that we wanted to share with the audience. Only about one-third of all adults in their early 20s are working full-time jobs.
As I keep reading a few more statistics, Michael, it doesn't get any better. During 2011, 53%, about half of all recent college graduates are working jobs that do not even require a college degree. In other words, they're not using their college degree.
Even though, incredibly, approximately two-thirds of all college students graduate with student loans. And in America today, 40% of all households that are led by someone under the age of 35 are paying off a student loan debt. Back in 1989, that figure was below 20%.
Now, next, I have a statistic that I've seen before that I've always been utterly shocked by. Think about this. Think about how much debt there is on credit cards all over the United States. Add that all together, and what do you get? You get the fact that the total amount of student loan debt in the United States exceeds the total amount of credit card debt in the United States. Hard to believe. Everybody who puts everything on their credit card, from what they buy in the stores to all other kinds of things, food, everything you put on your credit cards, all that taken together does not amount to the student debt. Pretty shocking.
It's over $1 trillion, Michael. That's $1,000 billion. It's over that. It's amazing. According to the Pew Research Center, 57% of all Americans in the 18 to 24-year-old age bracket are living with their parents.
One poll discovered that 29% of all Americans in the age brackets 25 to 34 are still living with their parents. So basically, your parents raise you, they send you to college, perhaps you don't live there for a little while, perhaps you do, and then you come back home, and a third of you are still living with your parents up to age 34.
And that third is 25 million Americans, according to a Time magazine article. 25 million Americans who are adults are living with their parents. So you can't make a decent living even though you went to college, can't get a decent job, you can't get married, and you're living with your parents.
They ought to teach kindergartners that you're essentially living in supposedly the richest country with the lowest factors of health care, longevity, infant mortality, and almost everything else. And maybe the kids ought to learn, hey, maybe there's something wrong with this country.
Bye.
On Saturday, October 5th, I woke up to see the news that the United States military, various aspects of the military, had gone into two parts of Africa. In one case, they went into Libya and brazenly seized a man who they claim is a leader of al-Qaeda. His name is Abu Anas al-Libi. That's his nickname, I think. But he's actually Mr. Rukai, and they seized him out of Tripoli in Libya. The other incident that we awoke to see was that the U.S. went into Somalia and did a military attack on a house or a compound in apparently an effort to try and grab or kill, my guess is kill, but we don't know, a man who had a nom de guerre of Ikrima. I won't attempt to say his whole name, but I will, actually. Abdul Qadir Mohammed Abdul Qadir, better known as Ikrima. In the latter case in Somalia, they apparently were beaten back, which is pretty amazing. A U.S. military landing planned for months is beaten back in a city in Somalia. On the other hand, in the former case, they were able to kidnap Abu Anas al-Libi. We'll call him Abu Anas as we talk about the legality of what they did. It was pretty shocking news to see that the U.S. simply thinks that they can go into countries, sovereign countries, kidnap or kill whomever they want. But, of course, it shouldn't surprise us. I said it's shocking in a way. But, you know, since 9/11 and even before, we've seen incredible lawlessness by the country. We've seen drones, which are still going on. They simply kill people with drones, whether they're in a military conflict or not. We see people captured or kidnapped, rendered to other countries, as happened to one of the center's clients, Maher Arar. He was captured, actually taken off a plane at Kennedy Airport, but others all over the world, Abu Omar in Egypt, and sent to other countries for torture. We see people captured or kidnapped and taken to the United States for trial. There was a famous case of that a year or two ago, a guy named Warsami, taken off a boat in the sea off Somalia, held on the boat for 2 months, eventually brought here for trial. So it's going on all over. It's lawless. It's incredible. And I wanted to just take a minute to look at the situation, particularly the one in Libya where Abu Anas was seized in Libya. Let's just look at what the legality and what the underpinnings of that are. The first question is, did the U.S. have a right to go into Libya at all? And of course, Article 2.4 of the UN Charter says that the territorial integrity of a country is complete. It's 100%, except in the case of self-defense or authorized by the UN. So there was no authority from the UN or international law to go into that country, into Libya. And then the question came up, did Libya consent to it? And that, of course, we may never get to the answer. Today, when I read the paper, it made it appear as if Libya did not consent, because the U.S. claimed, or there seemed to be claims in the paper that, well, the U.S., a few months ago, they may have consented, or somebody gave consent a few months ago. It's an important issue. It's not the main issue we want to talk about because we don't know the answer, but it's likely, it seems to me, that Libya did not consent. But then let's think about what happened to Anas al-Libi. So he's apparently parking his car at his house where he's living in Tripoli. He has his children there, you know, in their late teens, early 20s. And he's apparently picked up by three cars with guns and everything. And, you know, the way these are normally done is they completely surround the guy. They strip his clothes off. They put a suppository in him. And then who knows how they transport him out of Libya and into where he is now, which is on a boat floating somewhere in the world, a U.S. ship. So the abduction itself, of course, could well constitute and probably does some form of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or torture. So you have to assume that Abu Anas was tortured or treated cruel and inhumane and degrading treatment. He is then taken somehow, which is they've revealed, he's on some U.S. ship floating somewhere. It's called the San Antonio. And even though, and this is a key fact in this case, even though the guy's been indicted in the United States for the 1998 attacks on the embassies in Nairobi and Tanzania,
And it's not clear what his role was. It's not clear if he had any role in those. But he was indicted for that. Even though he's been indicted, they're not taking him back immediately to the U.S. federal court in New York, but they're keeping him floating on this ship, apparently while they're going to interrogate him. Now, that seems, I mean, Michael, we both know enough about criminal law to know if you pick up someone on the street and you arrest them, what happens to them?
You take him to jail. You present him in front of a judge. He has the opportunity to get bail, hire an attorney, and defend himself.
And he gets Miranda warnings as well, because he's told anything you say can be used against you. Now, in this case, of course, none of that is being followed. He's not being presented before the federal judge. He may someday be presented before the federal judge in New York a month from now, 2 months from now. He's certainly not being given Miranda warnings from what we know, but he's being interrogated on a ship floating somewhere in the world. Now, that ship is a U.S. ship. So if the U.S. tried to argue, well, he's being held in Afghanistan or something or somewhere else, he's on U.S. territory, essentially.
Well, it's the law of the flag of the ship. Right. It's the American law.
So they're continually violating his rights. We'll go into whether they had any right to abduct them at all, but let's stay away from that for a second and just say he's on the ship now. So he's been abducted. Abduction is essentially against the law. He's been kidnapped. He's put into a ship. He's not presented to a federal court. He's essentially been disappeared because no one, as far as we know, his family says they haven't been notified of where he is. He hasn't been presented to a federal judge. He hasn't been given Miranda warnings, and he's going to be interrogated. And that's exactly what happened to another defendant a couple of years ago, Warsami. Now, how is he going to be interrogated? Is he going to be tortured when he's interrogated, or is he not going to be tortured? And the answer is, we don't know. It's true, Obama, when he took office 5 years ago, he banned torture. And he said all interrogations had to be done according to the Army Field Manual.
Well, that was the law. He just reaffirmed the law.
Right, he reaffirmed the law, but he left an exception in the Army Field Manual that can be used in a way that certainly constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or torture. And presumably, that's how he's being interrogated. That's how Abu Anas is being interrogated on this ship, with the interrogation techniques authorized by the Army Field Manual, and includes what's called Annex M. Annex M allows three kinds of techniques that I think constitute cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and taken together would constitute torture. That includes isolation from other people, solitary, sensory deprivation, and deprivation of sleep. And so those three, as I said, those are not good things to have authorized. And when they're taken together, they can authorize torture. Interestingly, just as an aside here, the New York Times did a piece by Charlie Savage and Benjamin Weiser called How the U.S. is Interrogating an Al-Qaeda Suspect. And you have to read it for just seeing, one, how favorable it is to the United States and how wrong it is. It says, of course, that they're being interrogated under the Army Field Manual, and it complies with Geneva, et cetera, and therefore these kind of things are outlawed. But of course, that's not true, as I just explained. So you have Abu Anas sitting in this ship, being interrogated for months, perhaps, until he lets them know whatever he's going to let them know. Then here's what happened with Warsami and is likely to happen in his case. After a couple of months, and after he's been subjected likely to all these Annex M deprivations, they will stop questioning him. They will have a break. And then they will tell him, well, now that we finished the intelligence part of this, now you have a right to an attorney, you have a right to Miranda warnings, and we'll bring you to the United States. They'll say, do you want to assert your Miranda rights not to talk? Do you want an attorney? The difference of those is important, because when you're doing intelligence gathering, that material cannot be used in the criminal trial. Once they tell him he has Miranda warnings, that can be used if he waives his right to remain silent. In Warsami's case, he waived his right to remain silent. So he just kept talking, which makes sense, because a guy who's been in interrogation for 2 months, he's already spilled the complete beans, or if there's beans to spill, he's all of a sudden told, well, now the next set of questions that we won't use the stuff against you. On the other hand, if you lie, you can be indicted for perjury, presumably. So the guy is, and he's already been like, quote, softened up with Annex M techniques, then they're going to send in what they call a clean team, and then the information can be used against him, and then he has a right, supposedly, to get an attorney. I mean, it would be laughable if it wasn't actually being done to a human being. Interesting, the federal legal defender,
from the Southern District of New York, where the indictment against Abu Anas is lodged, wrote a letter to the judge and maybe, and I think probably to U.S. military authorities, saying he has to be presented in federal court for a judge and he has to be given Miranda warnings, and we will represent him and want to represent him now because we believe what you're doing now is flatly illegal. So here you have this guy kidnapped in a way that likely violated his rights, not just to be free from abduction, but his physical well-being in terms of the way it was done, transported somehow, and they've done this by drugging people, putting them in coffin boxes, shipping them, etc., being physically abused and being taken to a ship, put on a ship, being then physically abused as being interrogated with no rights. And then all of a sudden, you and I will wake up in a couple months. He'll be sitting here in the Southern District of New York and having this, quote, fair trial. Now, let me just say, at the trial, and this is the last point I'll make on this, although we could talk about it and you may have some questions, Michael. At this, quote, fair trial, you would think he would have the right to say, well, I was illegally taken from another country. I was tortured on the way here or cruelly treated. I was interrogated in the wrong way, etc. You would think he have a right to raise that. But our courts say no. It's called, I'll just say it for once or twice, Kerr Frisbee. It doesn't mean anything to anybody. It's based on cases that the U.S. says that when you have your trial in the United States, even if you've been abducted and kidnapped in another country, you can't raise that. It has nothing to do with your criminal trial. It doesn't affect the jurisdiction of a U.S. court to try you. So they have it every way they want. But I want to close this by saying, and then see if Michael has any questions, to just say it's all part of a piece, whether it's drones or using kill teams to go around the world and kill people, or whether it's then abducting people and taking them to Guantanamo or sending them to Bagram. Right now, we have a situation where the president does whatever he wants to any human being anywhere in the world. It's utter and complete lawlessness.
Michael, one question. Do you think that this kind of disintegration of the rule of law internationally is going to eventually impact on American citizens here in our country?
I would say that it already has. It already has in the sense that they did, of course, have a couple of cases where they picked up U.S. citizens in this country and tried to try them as enemy combatants. They essentially never got struck down on it, but they realized as they got closer to the Supreme Court, they might have an issue. But it's certainly, if we look at the case you and I were talking about in our updates of Lynn Stewart and the shorthand way in which she was tried, with pictures of Osama bin Laden in the trial, with the claim of by issuing a press release that it's terrorism. Yes, so it comes home to our courts with everything from bringing Osama bin Laden into a trial to anonymous juries and scaring the juries and shortcutting things like electronic surveillance ability to get at. Yes. So I would say that as this happens, and we've seen it actually with some people who were picked up here on terrorism charges, particularly with regard to what we call presentment and Miranda. What they do is they exercise what they call the safety exception to the fact that you're supposed to be read your rights immediately when you're taken into custody by a police officer. You have the right to remain silent. You have a right to an attorney. They don't read those rights. They delay them on the grounds they want to interrogate you under a public safety exception because maybe you know where the next bomb or a bomb is going off. So that's widely abused. So the answer is yes, that we're already seeing it and we'll see more of it. My view is you can't justify this stuff overseas and it not come home to roost in America.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
October 7th of 2013 marked the 12th anniversary of the United States invasion of Afghanistan. The war now drags on into its 13th year. The Afghanistan War and the Iraq War have been estimated to cost taxpayers some $6 trillion. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. What was an illegal war, there were no weapons of mass destruction, which was the basis that was offered for the attack on a sovereign country. It was an illegal war launched despite millions of people protesting across the globe. We're joined today by returning guest Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Phyllis will talk to us about the current U.S. foreign policy in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also put it into focus given the recent developments in Iran and Syria. Phyllis Bennis, it's nice to have you back on Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
We want to kind of cover a big chunk of the Mideast waterfront when we have a chance with you, Phyllis. We wanted to talk to you about Syria and Iran and Iraq and finally with the Israel-Palestine discussion. But let's start off with Syria. Can you bring us up to date on what's going on there since they revealed that they're going to give up their chemical weapons?
Well, you know, on the one hand, it was a huge victory for the U.S. and global anti-war mobilization efforts that we managed to prevent what was a really imminent U.S. strike. The British also had their missiles ready to go. They were very close. But the combination of the British Parliament's decision to say no led to a huge shift in what the Obama administration was prepared to do, because it turns out they were prepared to go to war without U.N. permission, meaning it would have been illegal. So they're ready to go without the U.N. They're ready to go without NATO. They're ready to go without the Arab League, but they weren't ready to go without the Brits. That was the last vestige of political cover they thought they needed.
Yeah, I thought that was amazing.
It was amazing. And what a surprise. The British Prime Minister said, ugh, I hate you people, but we live in a democracy, so I'm going to do what you say. I'm not going to go to war. And that made it impossible for the Obama administration to just abandon all pretense of democratic accountability and go ahead. So they had to say, okay, let's go to Congress. And then if we go, Congress will share the blame if it's a debacle. And if we can avoid it, maybe we don't have to go to war now without losing too much face. Because keep in mind, this was all a political decision. This wasn't rooted in either concerns about international law or any kind of military or strategic necessity. The war had been raging for 2 years. More than 100,000 people had been killed on all sides. It was disastrous, and it continues to be. But it was really important that we did manage, after that British decision, when it was turned over to Congress, a lot of organizations mobilized and said, you know what, we're not going to let this happen. And the massive mobilization of groups and people across the country that were protesting outside, that were having vigils outside Congress, that were writing petitions and sending emails and phone calls. The members of Congress were reporting that their phone calls and their emails were running 500 to 1, 800 to 1, 1,000 to 1 against U.S. military intervention.
How do you account for that, Phyllis?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think, one, there was some really good work done really fast by a lot of good anti-war organizations who kept the focus on Congress, didn't get distracted by either worrying about trying to mobilize one big giant demonstration or something, didn't focus on everybody has to sign off on everything, which means you spend all your time in meetings. People just went to work. And what we found was that people around the country were simply not prepared to sign on to another war after so many failed wars in the region, after the failure of Iraq, the failure of Afghanistan, the failure of Libya. People were saying, we're not buying it anymore. You know, you can call that war fatigue, but it really is about people learning lessons, people learning that, you know, going to war is not an answer to these problems. And of course, there was also a right-wing isolationist current that was very powerful. We can't pretend it was all on the progressive side. Some of that was straight-up racist, if Obama wants it, I don't want it. Some of it was a kind of isolationism that's also racist in a different way, that basically says Syrians are not worth one drop of American blood, that sort of analysis. But that was important, too, because what it led to was a really bipartisan accidentally bipartisan consensus of people, not only of people in Congress, but of just ordinary people across the country. So when these right-wing Tea Partiers and whoever were going back to their district, they were hearing the same thing that progressive members were hearing. We don't want this war. And centrist members were hearing the same thing.
How do you explain Obama going on television and talking about the deaths of all these children and showing writhing young bodies on the hard floors of hospitals?
Horrible.
What do you say to that?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, the use of chemical weapons is a horrific crime, and it's a particular crime. It's not that it's the only crime of the only war crime or the only crime against humanity, but it's a particular one because there's a particular set of international laws that prohibit having or making and certainly using chemical weapons under any circumstances anywhere. So on one level, it's a good thing to be particularly outraged by that. On the other hand, given that there had been already more than 100,000 victims in this war, about a third of them civilians, about 43% of them regime soldiers and militia, about 18% of them rebel soldiers, the rest were civilians. So it's a kind of mixed bag. Everybody's being killed in huge numbers. To claim that this was all about the humanitarian consequences is simply, that's not the case. If it was really all about this was the first violation of international law and we were going to take it seriously, fine, but it wasn't. That wasn't what was going on. This was a political motivation. There was enormous pressure coming on the Obama administration, particularly following Obama's own really sloppy language a year ago when he used that stupid remark about red lines and said there will be consequences if there are chemical weapons in the picture, and didn't say the consequences will be military, but let it stand when all of the right-wing war hawks who have been pushing for war in Syria for more than 2.5 years, really since the beginning of the Arab Spring revolt there, the same people, McCain, Graham, they've all been saying we need to go to war in Syria way before chemical weapons were used. So there was pressure coming from them against Obama. There was pressure from a number of international allies, the leadership in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in Turkey, in France, in Britain, were all pushing for war. So there were pressures coming in that direction. And there's this constant pressure on Obama that, for whatever reason he responds to, that he's not tough enough. You know, the drone wars that he's waged apparently isn't good enough. The special ops that he's carried out, killing so many people, isn't good enough. People want more killing. So he was responding to that set of political pressures.
Let me ask you a question, Phyllis, and then I want to go to the bigger picture of where we are now. And this may be wrong about this, but I sort of looked at it as the Assad government was doing better and the rebels weren't doing very well. And while the U.S. didn't want to enter the war completely because that had no upside to it, you know, supporting, you know, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, that it would allow them to at least limit Assad's ability to win the war and really push the rebels into a smaller and smaller space, and that the chemical weapons could be used as an excuse for that. Now, I may be just completely off, but that's how when the process was going on, that's one thing I thought of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I don't think it's completely off. I think that was a factor, but I don't think it's a major factor. And the reason is that what they were actually planning to do, I don't think it was fake when, you know, it was always with the thumb and forefinger, just barely, you know, a tenth of an inch apart. It's going to be just a little teeny tiny strike.
Right.
It's hardly going to have any impact. On one level, I think that was true. They were really not planning more than a symbolic strike. And it was not going to change the situation on the ground.
Okay, well, that's
it wasn't really going to help the rebels militarily. And the reality is, I don't think they were so eager to help the rebels militarily because the military part of the opposition is a set of forces that nobody wants to support, including in the U.S. government.
Right.
Because the, you know, the so-called secular democratic forces, the Free Syrian Army, blah, 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 they're really not a force anymore on the ground militarily. They exist in exile. They go from meeting to meeting trying to come up with a unified position, and they've been failing every time. Their groups, six of their major groups on the ground, have just joined an Islamic-led coalition. So those who are fighting are really no longer the primarily the armed secular opposition. There's a few of them left, but very few. It's overwhelmingly Islamist forces, many of them quite extremist. And of course, the voices that have been marginalized the most are the voices of the original political opposition in Syria, who are incredibly brave, incredibly courageous, still out there fighting, still going into the streets saying no to military intervention, no to the repression of this regime, we want a new regime on our terms, reached democratically, not through military strikes. And many of them have been killed, many have been driven into exile, but some of them are still there. But their voices have been drowned out by the violence of all the other sides.
Phyllis, so let's get to the next step and then a slightly broader picture. The next thing that's going on is the chemical weapon stuff. And
Right. What's
going to be unfolding in Syria over the next period? And I think when we talked earlier, you mentioned it has a big effect on what the latest issues are on Iran as well as other parts of
Absolutely.
The Middle
East. Absolutely. You know, I think what we're looking at is two things. The chemical weapons developments are actually very positive. They're, you know, the fact that all of this political pressure, the fact that Russia and the U.S. came together, where both now have a stake in reaching a diplomatic settlement, means that the leadership in Syria, the regime in Syria, was forced to sign on to the chemical weapons treaty. That's huge. You know, there's only 7 countries in the world that had not signed that treaty, Israel, of course, being another one. They have not only their well-known nuclear arsenal, but they also have a chemical weapons arsenal and still haven't signed the treaty. But the fact that Syria was forced to sign the treaty is a very good thing. The fact that these international inspections are going on now, the Secretary General of the UN has just announced a broader plan that will send a broader team of both UN inspectors and inspectors from the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare to find and destroy that whole chemical weapons arsenal in Syria. That's all good. The problem is that really doesn't change the horrific nature of the war that's going on. The number of people killed with chemical weapons is tiny compared to the number of people killed with conventional weapons. And until there is a real move towards restoring the Geneva II process, the U.S.-Russian agreement to host international diplomatic negotiations aimed at ending the war, not just at getting rid of the chemical weapons, and that has to include a ceasefire and an arms embargo. If it doesn't, it's not going to work. That's what's on the table now, and that's what has to be, I think, for those of us that are concerned about Syria, that needs to be our demand. Don't let the U.S. go back to threatening missile strikes, but also make sure that the Geneva II talks are underway and that everybody's at the table, including Iran, with a ceasefire and an arms embargo, a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian support. Our work isn't done yet. The 5 wars in Syria, the regional power struggle, the sectarian war, the U.S.-Russia war, the U.S.-Israel versus Iran war, those are still underway in Syria. And all of this work on the chemical weapons by itself won't stop that.
Let's now talk about Iran, because we have a related issue there with their supposedly trying to get nuclear weapons, not chemical warfare, but nuclear weapons. Now there's been a really big breakthrough with both the United States and Iran talking to each other. Tell our audience about that, please.
Well, you know, this has been really a rather extraordinary few weeks. The prevention of U.S. missile strikes in Syria, the re-emergence of U.S.-Russian negotiations over Syria, and then all of a sudden, now we're talking to Iran as well. And, you know, despite the fact that that shouldn't be such a big deal, that's a huge deal, given that the U.S. has essentially had a no-contact position for years, where State Department officials above, you know, the most junior kind of intern level were absolutely prohibited from talking to their Iranian counterparts. State Department people were often told they had to leave the room at big public receptions if an Iranian official entered the room.
It's unbelievable.
It's really unbelievable.
Juvenile.
Exactly. And the result is, at the official level, the U.S. didn't have a clue what's going on inside Iran. Aside from what side you're on, if you want to understand what's going on somewhere, you need people on the ground. I mean, it's just really stupid. But all of a sudden now we're talking, foreign minister to foreign minister, Kerry to Zarif. That's all very good. So the speeches at the General Assembly, President Obama's speech, and he spoke with great respect about Iran. That was important. He didn't trot out his usual line about all options are on the table. He wasn't threatening the use of force. And he talked about Iran's right to access nuclear energy. Now, that's important. It's not good enough. It still isn't an acknowledgement that under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and I wish this wasn't the case, but it is, every non-nuclear weapon state has the right to two things. One is, it has the right, and this has never happened, to expect that official nuclear weapons countries, the U.S., the Russians, the Chinese, the Brits, and the French, to get rid of their nuclear weapons. That's the first thing they're promised. The second thing they're promised is to have the right to not only get nuclear energy, but to produce it themselves if they want to, and to be given the technology to do so. So this claim that the only way there can be an agreement with Iran is if they give up all enrichment is simply, it's not going to fly. It's a deal breaker. And President Obama didn't say that. So that was important. He didn't quite go as far as he needed, but by saying, at least referencing their right to accessing nuclear energy, you know, that's still pretty important. The other side, President Rouhani, the new president of Iran, was on a major charm offensive at the UN and across, you know, his visit to New York, and then, of course, in the famous phone call between the two presidents, between Obama and Rouhani. And that's important, not least because the Iranians have made it clear that Rouhani has the backing of the supreme leader, who actually does have far more control than the presidency over things like nuclear policy. So Rouhani has said, I have the backing of the supreme leader in a new approach to our nuclear negotiations. And Khamenei, the supreme leader, has said, yep, he's got my backing. So that's a really important shift, because that was not the case with Ahmadinejad. And I think that the coming together of those two positions makes this a very optimistic moment. The two dangers, and they're both very real, are one, there are enormous pressures in the U.S. from the arms industry, from AIPAC, from hawks in Congress of all sorts who are saying, this can't be done. The only way we can pressure Iran is to threaten military strikes. That's the only thing we can do, and we have to keep doing it. That will derail any possibility of negotiations if they go in saying, well, we'll talk, but, you know, we've got our missiles launched at you already. The other threat is that if there is to be any kind of a grand bargain between the U.S. and Iran, there will be a demand from Israel for some kind of a payoff.
I was just about to ask you about that. There's a zero-sum game here, I'm afraid, of what's going to happen, you think, to the Palestinians as a consequence of this.
The Palestinians will be the ones who pay the price if there is an agreement between the U.S. and Iran, because the U.S. will be determined to give Israel something to make up for the fact that they will be taking away from them their political line about Iran is an existential threat, and that's why we should continue to get $3.5 billion a year in military aid and absolute protection from the United States, absolute impunity at the United Nations, et cetera, et cetera. Once Iran is no longer the part of the so-called axis of evil, once Iran's relationship to the U.S. is normalized, some of those diplomatic possibilities for Israel are going to disappear. And in response to that, the U.S. is going to be under enormous pressure, and there is little doubt that the Obama administration will agree, to give Israel something that will, quote, make up for the fact that the U.S. is treating Iran as a normal country and not as a pariah. That something is likely to come at the price of Palestinian rights. You guys will remember back in 2004, there was the exchange of letters between then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and then President George Bush about what a final settlement should look like, in which, among other things, Bush said, and of course there will be no right of return. It was like as if the right of return was his to give away. Yeah. That's what we can expect again.
Can you bring us up to date, even if only a nutshell, about what's going on in Iraq?
Iraq has become as violent as it was at the height of the sectarian wars of 2006 and 2007. Hundreds of people are being killed on a daily basis. There are bombings going on, even in the Kurdish area that had been much more quiet, much more peaceful, if you will. There are bombings, there are assassinations of political figures. It's a disaster. Much of that is a result of the exploding war in Syria. Syria and Iraq share a long border. It's a very porous border. Both the sectarian and the regional character of the war in Syria gets reflected in Iraq. Syria has an Alawite leadership with a Sunni majority. The Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam. In Iraq, it's sort of the opposite. It's a Shia majority and now a Shia-led government with a Sunni minority that's opposing the government. But you have a similarity, a parallel, and with the border being so porous, you have fighters who trained by fighting against U.S.-backed forces in Iraq flooding into Syria to join the opposition in Syria. You have, you know, a huge regionalization of the war in Syria, and much of that is being played out in Iraq at the expense of ordinary people trying to rebuild their lives after a decade of this devastating war.
So this is all an eventual consequence of the American grand plan, what they initially called, but they withdrew from it, Operation Iraqi Liberation Oil. Mm-hmm. And then they stopped talking about that because it was too embarrassing.
Yeah, and changed
they did,
it to so Operation Iraqi Freedom.
They didn't
freedom.
Get the oil, yeah. did they? But they did get utter chaos in four different
countries.
They got countries.
Chaos. They didn't get oil, although you could certainly argue that Iraqis lost the oil. It just didn't all go to American oil companies. It's, you know, the whole world is now in there fighting oil company to control Iraq's oil, and it's only Iraqis that are left out of the picture.
You'd mentioned a little earlier the problems in Libya, just alluded to it. And as I read about the abduction of Abu Anas by the U.S. from Libya, the articles were filled with essentially, that I would read it as a completely failed state, chaotic. As one of the people I know, I opposed the war, feeling that it could certainly lead to what it's led to in other places. Was it a failed state? What is it? What's going on?
It's a disaster in Libya. The government has very little control. The militias that were created in the context of the fight to overthrow Gaddafi, that was then backed by the U.S. and NATO, have refused to disarm and refused to come under the authority of any kind of national government. So you have parts of the country under control of these separate militias. Many of the militias are still holding prisoners in large numbers, human rights violations that are of unbelievable severity. The whole question of governmental control of the country is simply not, it's simply a fiction at this point. The division of Libya into two or perhaps even three separate regions is a very likely possibility. Hasn't happened yet on a legal basis, but it certainly is beginning that way. The oil-rich east, centered by Benghazi, Tripoli in the west without oil, and the African regions of the south that are less identified with the Arab world and more with Africa. There's a huge set of problems. The economy is in shambles. Unemployment is skyrocketed. Public services are virtually non-existent. It's a mess, and it is also, as we've seen, an incredibly dangerous place for people to live. Violence is endemic, and then you have this sense, I mean, the reason that the U.S. simply went in on this raid to arrest somebody is that they felt like there was nobody, legitimacy aside, they felt that at the practical level there was no operative government that had the capacity to carry out an arrest. Yeah. And where they could apply for asking that he be turned over for trial in the United States. There's simply no functional government.
Yeah, well, that doesn't excuse them for going in. That was,
of course not. The legitimacy is a huge challenge.
Of what they did there. Anyway, let's close the book on that, at least momentarily, because we wanted to talk to you about the loss of a friend and a comrade, Saul Landau. He was central, really, to the workings of the Institute for Policy Studies. A student at the University of Wisconsin before I got there, so I knew about him before I ever knew him and really loved and admired him. And I know you and Michael did as well, and I wanted to just ask you for your thoughts about Saul.
You know, Saul was a giant of our movement. He was an extraordinary filmmaker. He made one of the first films about Fidel. It was called Fidel. He made it in 1960, in the first year after the revolution. He went to Cuba, hung out with Fidel, played baseball with him, filmed him in extraordinary circumstances, and then he's made other films about Cuba, most recently his film about the Cuban Five, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up. He died about a month ago after a two-year battle with a very virulent cancer, and even up until the very end, he was working on what will be his last film. It's being completed by his partner filmmaker, John Alpert, about the gay rights movement in Cuba, which is, you know, a whole new movement that I think most people don't know anything about. But Saul was somebody, you know, he had been at IPS almost from the beginning. I think it was 5 or 6 years after the founding of IPS, Saul joined. And he was the one, more than anyone, who was the most persistent in insisting that IPS take seriously the need for a real investigation after the assassination of our comrades, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt in 1976 at the hand of the Chilean military junta led by General Pinochet. It was Saul who said, "We know Pinochet was responsible, but we're going to prove it." And he spent 3 years working with others. He worked with an FBI agent that was willing to help out. He wrote the extraordinary book, Assassination on Embassy Row, that documented with such precision exactly how Operation Condor had gone forward that had led to the assassination of Orlando Letelier, who had, of course, been Chile's ambassador to the U.S. under the Allende government, and then when he went into exile after being released from prison after the coup, came to work at IPS. It was while he was at IPS that he worked at the UN to help create the new international economic order. And he and Saul worked very, very closely together. Saul's commitment to Latin America, his involvement in Latin America, in Chile, in Cuba, and elsewhere, was central to his identity, to what he did. And he was an extraordinary teacher, a teacher of film arts, a teacher of poetry. He was a great poet, often a funny one. You know, his books were funny and serious all at once. He was a giant among us, and he's sorely, sorely missed.
He really had a wonderful sense of humor. I had a correspondence with him right before the end, and I was telling him what I was doing. I had just finished co-editing a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, about what it would be like if we didn't have capitalism in this country. And I said, you know, it's an ancient idea. Isaiah talks about it. It goes all the way back to the Old Testament when the lion would lay down with the lamb. And Saul wrote back and he said, if the lion ever lays down with the lamb, the lamb's not going to get any sleep.
That was very much Saul. His usual sign-off line on the phone in the last weeks before he died was, "Cancer schmancer, at least you've got your health."
Phyllis Menes from the Institute for Policy Studies, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.